The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Great to see you. I had the money. I could afford it, and I'd chosen the colour already, mica orange. I was going to be the latest Commodore. I remember the day I walked down. I walked into Sutton's Holden down here, down the road at Rosebery, and spoke to the salesman. Said, "I want mica orange." He said, "Okay, we can do that." I said, "I want a five-speed Commodore, not automatic. I want a five-speed manual." He said, "Oh, yeah, we don't make many manual Commodores. It will take 8 weeks to get that made at the factory." He said, "It's all right, I can wait. I'll wait for it." It wouldn't be a V8, it would only be a V6, but I thought, well, that will be adequate. And I had already worked out what it would be called. It would be known as the Tiger. And so I knew it would bring me enormous pleasure, and I began to wait the 8 weeks. If you were completely cashed up, what is it that you could have that would bring you great pleasure? What is it that you would really like? I reckon I don't need to give you too much time to think about that because you've probably thought of it already. If you had the cash, this would bring me, whatever it is, would bring me great pleasure. In fact, the question today is it possible to build a life on the pursuit of pleasure? To make the pursuit of pleasure the central plank of our lives? How does that work? How does that look? Now, the book of Ecclesiastes in the Old Testament, in fact, some of you are holding it already, that little booklet is a part of the Old Testament, part of the Bible, and the book of Ecclesiastes deals with, and look at part of that booklet today that deals with the idea of pleasure. But I need to, in case you weren't here last week, I need to just get you up to speed about the main question of the book and the structure of the book. So have a look with me at chapter 1, verse 1. I know. The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Written by King Solomon, the son of David, or through his eyes. We're not exactly sure which one. Solomon, king in Israel about 950 BC, was the patron of the wisdom literature in the Old Testament. And so either written by Solomon or through his eyes towards the end of his life. And here's his beginning statement and how he sees the world. Chapter 1, verse 2. "Meaningless, meaningless," says the teacher, "utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless." Now, it's very hard to translate that word, the Hebrew word hebel or hevel, into English. The NIV translation here has gone for meaningless, and I can see why. What it really means is the idea of a mist or a vapor or something that doesn't last. And it's the idea of something that, it's not saying good or bad, it's just saying it's ephemeral. It's like your breath on a very cold morning. Breathe out, you can see it, and then it's gone. And he's saying, all of life feels like this. And so life feels like a mist or sandcastles maybe, something that just is there and then it doesn't last. It's not substantial. And so verse 3, chapter 1, verse 3, gives us the big question of the whole book that he writes. What do people gain from all their labours at which they toil under the sun? What do people gain at all their labours at which they toil under the sun? The word gain there is a commercial term. We might say, what's the bottom line? What's the cash value? What's left after all of our work? The word labour can include physical labour or the mental anguish that comes with work. So if you work with a shovel, a hammer or a mouse, it covers it. And then that little phrase, under the sun, 29 times in just 12 short chapters. What does he mean? As far as I can work it out, what he means is if you just look out at the world as we see it, with eyes and ears open, what happens? What is the world like under the sun? Now, he's not an atheist. He regularly says God is there. He knows that. And yet, if God hadn't spoken to us, if we didn't have extra information, you'd almost say if the rest of the Bible was closed, how would you make sense of life? What do we notice? So the question we spoke about last week was, you'll work around 9 to 10,000 days in a working life. You'll work hard. There's lots of stress. What's the bottom line? What's left? If you haven't read it yet, chapter 1 will say, The world of nature goes on and on and on forever, and we're only here for 5 minutes. Then he goes on to say, we're only here for 5 minutes, and we get bored. And we can be bored with anything, even catching great barramundi. Bored with anything, it's hard to change things. And so what he does, he says, well, Solomon had a reputation of being an incredibly wise man. I'm the wisest man. I'm going to go on a quest and find what really lasts, what is substantial, what you can build your life on. Have a look at chapter 1, verse 12. He says, I, the teacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. I applied my mind to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under the heavens. And if you haven't read this little book, it's only 10 pages in my Bible, or this little booklet. If you haven't read it, you could take it with you if you like. And he sets out to find what's the answer. We'll see the second half of verse 13. What a heavy burden God has laid on mankind. And what's the burden? I think the burden is this, that we are aware of the brevity of our lives. There's an existential angst that we carry around. Verse 14, I have seen all things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, are chasing after the wind. It's that feeling of things aren't quite right. And it's a burden that humanity carries that other creatures don't seem to. So in the morning now it's cold, so I turn the heater on for my senior citizen Staffordshire Terrier. He kind of looks at me and says, oh, come on, Dad, don't be a cheapskate. How about the heater? So I turn it on, and as he lies back in front of the heater, I can't see any existential angst. He's just, you know, come back in September when the weather warms up. I'll be here till then. And yet we carry it around. And there's certain intractable problems. See verse 15. What is crooked cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. I think he's meant there's problems that we just can't fix. Here's one. I've got two United Nations reports that I found on the web. The first one says 11% of people on the planet are undernourished or struggle with hunger. It's 815 million people. 11% struggle with hunger, and 13% struggle with obesity. Now, why can't we fix that? Or we even create our own problems. So we're smart enough to split the atom, and that should make unlimited useful power. And what do? We take that and create weapons that could well destroy the whole human race. Or we create the internet, the greatest communication thing imaginable, and then we flood it with pornography and have to police it for predators. Now, maybe the answer's in wisdom. Let's have a look. See, so chapter 1, verse 16. I said to myself, look, I've increased in wisdom more than anyone who's ruled over Jerusalem before me. I have experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. And then I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly. But I learned that this too is a chasing after the wind. For with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. In verse 18, the more knowledge, the more grief, the more wisdom, more sorrow. Have you ever stopped to think, why is it that little kids are so excited and enthusiastic about life? Answer, they're really dumb. They actually can't say that, can you? Reality hasn't bitten them yet. So last time we went to the Royal Easter Show, there's the clowns. Every child wins a prize. And I want to say to the little guys that I'm taking, yeah, you'll win a prize. I don't know what that costs now, $5, $7, and the prize will be worth 5 cents and it'll just be junk and we'll throw it away tomorrow. Let's go get a show bag, Dad. Well, yeah, okay, we can get a show bag. We can queue up. We can pay exorbitant prices for a kilo of sugar and toys that will break straight away. You'll eat all the sugar. You'll throw up on the bus on the way home. Then we'll have a fight. And then, okay, here we go. And as you get older, more and more of life feels like show bags or knowledge. History. Now, not all of history, but enough of it is basically one group of people inflicting pain on another, isn't it? I listen to podcasts while I'm at the gym. Here's two that are excellent. Dan Carlin, Hardcore History, and Daniele Bolelli. He's an Italian guy who lives in the USA. Both brilliant long-form podcasts about history, and yet almost everything they cover is one group of people inflicting misery on another. And yet, isn't that the way we so often learn wisdom as we grow older? It's through pain. Okay, forget about wisdom. How about we just throw ourselves into having a good time? See, chapter 2, verse 1. I said to myself, come now, I'll test you with pleasure to find out what is good. But that also proved to be meaningless. Now, he's not saying it's bad. The meaningless word doesn't mean bad. It means it doesn't last. It slips through your fingers. It's a mist. Now, what's he talking about? Essentially, I think what he's saying is, let's have a go or look at hedonism. What's hedonism? Well, the pursuit of pleasure or sensual self-indulgence. And as a philosophy of life or a worldview, the ethical theory that pleasure, in the sense of satisfaction of desires, is the highest good and proper aim of human life. So the idea, let's make the pursuit of pleasure the central plank or the meaning and purpose of our life. So away he goes. 2:2. Laughter, I said, is madness. And what does pleasure accomplish? Laughter is a little bit crazy, isn't it? If you watch a stand-up comedy thing on Netflix and turn the sound down and watch people laugh, they look a little... Anyway, you can see why he says it. And then what does pleasure accomplish? Well, let's see. Chapter 2, verse 3. I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly. My mind still guided me with wisdom. I wanted to see what was good for people to do under the heavens during the few days of their lives. So a few drinks, let's have a party. And Solomon was truly cashed up. He was a very, very wealthy man. And so he could have whatever he wanted. Let me read to you chapter 2, verses 4 to 9 very quickly, because you'll get the idea. I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired male and female singers and a harem as well, the delights of a man's heart. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. If you could have anything you wanted, money was no object, what would you have? Now, it's interesting. If you're cashed up today, the list is very similar. So, for example, Bill Gates, depending on which month it is, Bill Gates is the world's richest man. It's kind of an arm wrestle with Jeff Bezos of Amazon. Bill Gates spent $63 million and 7 years building his house in Seattle, and he called it Xanadu. Now, I think if you can call your house Xanadu and keep a straight face, you are really loaded, and it's some house. Anyway, you can check out on the net and read all about it. If your budget isn't quite that, Sydney Morning Herald Domain will deliver your own personal Xanadu or the options week by week. Or verse 7, servants or slaves, and the word can be translated either way. You could have a pool boy, a maid, someone to walk your dog, etc. Verse 8, I acquired male and female singers. He had entertainment. There's a story I like that when James Packer and Jodie Mears got married, my guess is one of them liked Elton John songs. And so at their wedding, they had Elton John songs performed by Elton John. And Dad Kerry paid $1.2 million for Elton John to sing for 2 hours. To 650 guests. I'm going to the news reports. I wasn't invited. Or verse 8, a harem as well, the delights of a man's heart. I'll just let that one go through, I think. Or verse 9, fame and fortune, I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. Verse 10, I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused to my heart no pleasure. Any self-indulgence you want. Now, I've been looking around. The most indulgent thing that I can find is this. Aristotle Onassis, the Greek shipping magnate, he's the one that married Jackie Kennedy in 1968, one of the world's richest men at the time, owned a yacht. Fair enough, that's what rich guys do, called the Christina. In the Christina was a bar, yeah, fair enough, and the seats around the bar stool, were upholstered with the foreskins of minke whales. I don't know about you, but it just seems a tad indulgent. But anyway, verse 10, halfway through, chapter 2, verse 10, my heart took delight in all my labour, and this was my reward for all my toil. He enjoyed accumulating all of this stuff and getting it together and all the plans, etc. And then verse 11, 2:11, yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. He says it was all empty. It was all a mist. It didn't satisfy. Now, that's hard to believe, isn't it? It's hard to believe that you could have so much money and so many things. And yet, here's my question for you. Why do we assume it was different for him than for us? Because he had a few extra zeros at the end. Why do we think it's different just if you have bigger and shinier rather than what we've got? And why would it be any different for him? So I'd had the Tiger a couple of months, driving it around. And I was working for City Bible Forum at the time. I pulled up in Druitt Street, just down the hill from Town Hall. And we'd run a meeting there that night and with some of my colleagues, one of whom is here. I walked in with about three of my colleagues and a lovely Asian lady called Denise Chi. She's a lovely, sweet, gentle, sincere lady. And as we walked out carrying these boxes, these three jokers that I work with and with Denise, we walked up to the Tiger. She looked at it as they were all standing there and she said, "Al, what a beautiful colour. Pumpkin." And there was a pause as these guys heard the word pumpkin, and in the flash, quicker than Cinderella, the Tiger turned into the pumpkin. And that's what I was known as for the next while, until I sold it. It was just not the same anymore, driving around in the pumpkin. Aren't our pleasures ephemeral? I sold it a couple of months later to a mate who lived in the country, and I didn't mention the P word. Look at 2 verse 11. "Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless. A chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun." He's not saying these things are bad in themselves. What he's saying is they're a mist. They're chasing the wind, if that's the centre of life. Now, hedonism will always be empty, I think. Eventually be empty. Let me give you three quick reasons why. One, hedonism is always about the next thing. So it's like splashing your face with cold water. Feels good, but the water always runs through your fingers. And there'll always be the next thing. So we own the thing, or we have the experience, or we travel to the place, or we eat at the restaurant, and then very quickly, what's next? What's next? And ladies and gentlemen, aren't your cupboards at home, your garage, your lounge rooms full of these things that we had to have, and now they're ordinary? In fact, maybe so ordinary that we don't see them. They talk about the hedonic treadmill. You can see that's an image that makes sense. So we live in a society with maxed out credit cards. In fact, we owe $45 billion roughly on our credit cards, and empty hearts. And council cleanups are the things that we had to have 5-10 years ago put out to make room for the other things now that we have to get. And so the treadmill continues. That's the first reason. Second reason is this: it's about being seen very often. Now, it may not come as a surprise how shallow I am, but I did think it would be nice to be seen to be driving around in the Tiger and have that, you know, known to own a car that was so pretty, etc. And isn't that what so much of social media is about? It's one lady I know who said, "My husband says if it's not on Facebook, it never happened. Be seen to eat these things, go to these places, own this stuff." But the biggest reason, the third reason, hedonism is fundamentally selfish. Fundamentally. Look again at chapter 2, verses 4 to 10. And let me just read. You may not have noticed I read it so quickly. Just listen as I emphasise it. He says this: "I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself." Verse 7, "Slaves were born in my house." Verse 8, "I amassed silver and gold for myself." Verse 10, "I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my labour." It's fundamentally selfish. It's about me and my pleasures. I think, oh, no, I share it with my friends. Okay, well, it's about my friends or my family. And here's the great irony. If you live life only for self, our lives shrink. Our lives shrivel. It's what Jesus warns about. In Mark chapter 8, verse 35, Jesus says, "For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it." Now, he's talking here about an eternal reality, that if we reject him, if we refuse to accept his gift of forgiveness, if we hold on to our own life and our own will, etc., ultimately we'll lose that in eternity. But it's true just day by day. The more selfish we are, the more self-centered we are, the more it's all about us, the more our life and relationships begin to shrink down. Now, the Bible doesn't say that pleasure is a bad thing or to avoid pleasure. In fact, the Bible goes out of its way to say God made all these beautiful things for us to enjoy, and we should. It's just saying if you make pleasure the meaning of life, ultimately it'll be found to be empty. So, well, wait a minute, what about happiness as a goal? Happiness and pleasure are hard to kind of, they're kind of intertwined. Well, here's a definition of happiness. The Psychology Today website, 2015, what's your definition of happiness? This is, I guess, a working definition. A happy person is someone who experiences frequent positive emotions, such as joy, interest, pride, and infrequently, though not absent, negative emotions such as sadness and anxiety. So it's all about positive emotions, happiness. But happiness can be so fleeting, so hard to hold on to. If you catch a train to Bondi Junction, you may have noticed that Deliveroo, the food delivery service on the net, have taken over all the escalators for advertising. And the one they've got up is from hungry to happy. Now, if you're a bloke, you know that's true, actually. Okay? So I'm hungry, I'm unhappy, Kathy cooks a roast or something like that, I'm very happy. Kathy says I'm shallow as if it's a negative. I don't know why, but anyway, happiness can be as fleeting as what's in front of me to eat, one way or the other. Now, what's interesting, the Bible doesn't say make pleasure the center of your life. It doesn't say pursue happiness. What does it say? Contentment. Contentment is the key. And so the Apostle Paul says this in Philippians chapter 4. Just listen, we're not quite aligned there, but let me read it to you. As the Apostle Paul writes to the Christians in Philippi, northern part of Greece, he's in prison, facing possibly the death penalty, and they have supported him and cared for him as they were able for about 10 years, had a relationship with him. But he says this from his prison cell. He says, I've learned to be content whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I've learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do all this through him who gives me strength. Now, that last verse, Philippians chapter 4, verse 13, is often, or you see sportsmen, athletes, put that on an armband, Philippians 4, 13, or sometimes I've seen NFL footballers put it under their eyes for night games. Tevita Kiridrani with the Philippians 4:13 on his armband. I don't think it actually helps beat the All Blacks. In fact, I don't think it's actually about sport at all. Good on him for putting a Bible verse, although that can be a bit risky these days, I understand, if you're a wallaby. It's not about sport, ultimately. What's it about? You see what Paul says? It's about God giving him the strength to be content, the ability to see and understand the good things that he has, that what he has ultimately is enough. Here's a quote from an American pastor, Darren Patrick. He says this, at the heart of contentment is an embrace of the present and a willingness to enjoy the good things we have right now. Contentment is freedom from the cares of the past and concern for the future. Right? Contentment is freedom from the cares of the past and concern for the future. It's the ability to actually focus on and enjoy the good things that we have now. And the key to that, I think, is gratitude. Certainly gratitude to God who gives us those good things. And that's what Ecclesiastes will go on to say. If you have a look, you can have a look at the end of chapter 2, verse 24. He says, a person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their own toil. This too, I see, is from the hand of God. For without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? It's the gift of God to be able to enjoy what we have now, to find pleasure in the things that we have, rather than always be looking for the next thing or always be looking for more and more. Darren Patrick in that book talks about the assassins of contentment, the things that destroy contentment. And he lists regret, nostalgia, fear of the future, and a couple that I am particularly guilty of, multitasking, trying to do too many things, and hurriedness. So it's rushing around rather than slowing down and being able to appreciate the good things that we have now. So I was talking to my wife the other day. We pulled up behind a beautiful new Commodore, and I said to her, we need to buy a Commodore. And then she said these crazy things, like she says, as if they're right. She says, why should we when you'll be bored with it in a few months? She said, and it won't fit in the garage anyway. Yeah. And the little car that we've got goes really well. In fact, it will not die, actually. We've got a 10-year-old Golf. So I think we should just stick with the car we've got. And you know what? She's absolutely right. And am I content? I'm working on it. I'm working on it. Here's one last quote from Darren Patrick. The contented life is a powerful life. It means recognising and staying within our limits and embracing our work and our pleasure with equal gusto. It is a powerful life because it recognises that contentment is a quality of the soul and not our circumstances. And it enables us to find good in the midst of pain and suffering that few others can see. So what's the secret to contentment? It's actually to trust God and to be able to be thankful and appreciate the good things that we have. And you know what? To enjoy the pleasures that we have, to enjoy them, but to realise they're not the meaning of life. They may not last, but they're still good. Now, what does really last? What is the base that you can build a life on? What really will give life meaning and value that truly, deeply lasts? Well, he comes to that at the end of the book, and I'm not going to tell you now. You could read it for yourself, which is good, or come back next week when he says, well, if it's not pleasure, maybe it's money. Maybe just having more and more money will be the answer. But we'll come to that next week. Okay, folks, as usual, some excellent questions. Is the distinction you are drawing between pleasure and the pursuit of pleasure? I think the distinction I'm drawing is this, is trying to think that pleasure will be the centre of life. So the point on the definition of hedonism is that the pursuit of sensual pleasure becomes, is the highest good and proper aim of human life. I think that's where the problem is. If you make pleasure that, it will ultimately be found to be empty. I think what the Bible would say is take pleasure as it comes and enjoy it, but don't think it's going to be the meaning of life. The book that I quoted is called The Dude's Guide to Manhood by Darren Patrick. I picked it up for $2 at a bookstore. It's not a great book, I'm sorry. It's got a great chapter on contentment. So I've sucked the juice out of it for you, I think, already. If you want to borrow it from me, you can. Or you can buy it from me for $2. That's what it cost me. But his chapter on contentment is very good. So I'm content that I paid $2 for it, actually. John Piper often says something like, quote, God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied in him. Do you agree? Yes, it's from John Piper's book, Desiring God. And John Piper describes himself as a Christian hedonist. I suppose that's right. They're his words. God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied in him. The Westminster Confession says the chief end of mankind is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. It's interesting that in Genesis chapter 3, the great sin, if you like, is couched in terms of the man and the woman's refusal to believe that God is good and God is wise and God wants what's ultimately best. And so to disobey him and do your own thing will be better for you in the end. So the fundamental thing of faith is actually to believe that God wants what is best for us. I think I can say that. I'm not sure about the first one here. The author in 1:13 describes the study of wisdom as a heavy burden God has laid on men. This seems incongruous. I think what he's saying in Ecclesiastes is the more, if all you have is under the sun, the more you look at life and the more you analyze life, the more you really think, the more existential angst you will have. I'm reminded of one man who said, Socrates said, the unexamined life is not worth living. I'd say the examined life makes you wish you were dead. So I think what he's saying in Ecclesiastes is if all we have is under the sun, don't think too much, just kind of enjoy what you can. I think that's the point. The more you drill down, the more you think, the more of a burden you carry. If you think about university, it was the philosophy students who carried large books and looked haunted. The engineers just got drunk and played football. They enjoyed university more. Why would anyone want to be a leader in 2019? At least in ancient times, you did have these material benefits. I'll just take that as a comment. We'll see who's the leader after Saturday night, I guess. How should a Christian decide when to, firstly, delay enjoying a pleasure or activity, to indulge immediately in something desired, or something not to have the decide not to have the desired pleasurable activity? As far as I can see, the Bible is never ascetic in the sense that doing without pleasure or denying yourself of physical comfort or pleasure is a good thing in itself. You may choose to do without pleasure or choose to do without certain benefits, etc., but it's always actually for a greater purpose. You may do that in terms of, say, fasting, that kind of thing, to help you pray or to learn humility or dependence on God. Jesus himself fasted in the wilderness. But the bigger theme in, say, the New Testament is you may choose to do without pleasure that you could have for the good of other people. So instead of buying the yacht or the second yacht or the third holiday house or whatever, you may choose to use that money to actually invest in the lives of others, to help the poor, to etc. And so you may not live, to follow Jesus is not to live the biggest, best, brightest lifestyle you ever could, but to actually use your resources for the good of others. And the same with time and et cetera, relationships. And so it's a balance. Pleasure is not wrong and to enjoy yourself is not wrong. In 1 Timothy chapter 4, Paul says, everything that God created is good and should be enjoyed with thankfulness and prayer. And at the same time, he spent his life sacrificially serving and caring for others. So there's a balance in there. Delayed gratification is a whole other topic, I think. How does multitasking assassinate contentment? Good question. I think the starting point for contentment is thankfulness for what we have. Thankfulness for what we have. Multitasking or just busyness, I think, actually crowds out the opportunity to be truly thankful and content. I think you need to be able to pause and stop and think. So in the mornings, most mornings I'll sit quietly and read a part of the Bible and pray, etc. And I know when I do pause properly and make a little list of things that I should be thankful for, it's very good for the soul. And so I think that just the idea of multitasking and busyness can get in the way of that. And then if contentment is the key, how do we get contentment? Isn't contentment the something of the thing that if you try to find it, you will lose it? I think I disagree with the premise there. I think happiness, if you pursue happiness on its own, you'll never actually find it. It's too ephemeral. It comes, it goes, whatever. But I think you can learn contentment. Just like we can learn gratitude. It's interesting that even those who don't believe in a personal God now hear more and more people talking about giving back, about practicing thankfulness. I think we're hardwired up for that. It's those who actually know God through Jesus who have can be thankful to a person for the good things in our lives.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.